And welcome to the Rick House. Folks, my name is Cyrus Farmer. You are watching and listening to the Stomp the Tea podcast, coming to you on a Friday morning, the morning after a couple of preseason games were played in the NFL, and we have a lot to get into for this week's show. Folks, let me tell you a little bit about what you can expect to hear. We are going to be continuing our end of summer series about iconic sports theme music. I really think you're going to like today's entry. There's a ton of information about it. I think you're going to enjoy it. We're also going to be talking about the last and final episode of Live Aid, When Rock and Roll Took on the World, the CNN documentary that focuses on that event. And they aired their fourth and final episode this past Sunday. We will get into it and what I thought about it. Finally, we're also going to be talking about the best quarterbacks to never have made a Super Bowl appearance. Folks, this list, to me, I thought was fascinating. And the list is shorter than you think. We're going to get into all of that and why it matters right as soon as we actually get to that part of the show. Now, folks, let me just warn you in advance. There is no what are you drinking tonight, simply because we're recording on a Friday morning and, only thing I'm drinking this morning is coffee. So, without further ado, let's get into the show. Today's entry in the iconic sports theme music segment is a piece of music that's really two pieces of music wrapped into one. It is a fascinating piece and a fascinating story about how these pieces of music became connected to the event that we're talking about. Now, what event are we talking about? We're talking about the Olympics and the Olympic themes. Now, as I said just a moment ago, the Olympic theme music that you know and love, that is all composed as two separate compositions that were combined into one song in 1996. For the Atlanta Games by NBC. But the first part goes something like this. And again, I'm going to sing it so that we don't have run into any copyright issues and we have dead air. But it goes like this. Bum, bum, ba-dum, bum, 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 ba-da-bum, bum, bum, ba-da-bum, bum, bum, ba-da-bum, bum, bum. That's the Olympics. When you hear that piece of music, the instant thought that comes to mind is the Olympics. Now, that piece of music was composed by a French film and television composer named Leo Arnaud. Now, Arnaud studied at elite music conservatories in France with Maurice Ravel and Vincent Dindy. And Arnaud immigrated to the U.S. in 1931. Now, after about 5 years of working for a band leader, a very popular band leader in the U.S., Arnaud took a job at MGM where he would spend the next 30 years. Now, the title of Arnaud's composition is called Bugler's Dream. And it wasn't written specifically for the Olympics. This piece of music was commissioned by a man named Felix Slatkin, who would occasionally conduct over at 20th Century Fox, their musical department. Now, Slatkin was putting together an album of military music, and he commissioned this song from Leo Arnaud. And this piece of music appeared on a record released by Capitol Records in 1958. The name of the record was called Charge with an exclamation point. That was released in 1958, okay? So, fast forward a few years. Rune Ardage, who is the legendary former head of ABC Sports, he is the man behind Monday Night Football. He eventually took over ABC News as well. A legendary, legendary, iconic figure in the history of television. So he was running ABC Sports at the time. And he asked one of the engineers to find some music for ABC's coverage of the Olympics. The quote is, he wanted a piece of music that somehow would symbolize the grandeur of the games. So he charged this employee from the engineering department to scour the musical library and get him some options that he could use for ABC's coverage. Now, this employee returned with 6 options. And according to company lore, Arledge only listened to the album Charge. Now, when he listened to Charge, he was struck by Bugler's Dream instantly. And the day before he left for the site of the 1964 Winter Olympics, that year it was being held in Innsbruck, Austria, Arledge made his selection of Bugler's Dream to open ABC's coverage of the 1964 games. Now, there's a little bit of a dispute between when ABC actually debuted Bugler's Dream. Some places will tell you they debuted in the 1964 Winter Games. Some people say it wasn't used until the 1964 Tokyo Summer Games. Some people say it wasn't used by ABC until as late as 1968, the Mexico City Games. Be that as it may, the most popular consensus is that it debuted in the 1964 Summer Olympics held in Tokyo, and it was an instant hit. It was used for Olympic coverage by ABC moving forward for every Olympics since 1964. Now, Bugler's Dream was the standard as far as music being played for the Olympics until the 1984 Summer Games in Los Angeles. Now, what happened then? In 1984, the famous composer, John Williams, he of E.T., Jaws, he's written a million different pieces of movie music that we all know and love incredibly well. John Williams was tasked with creating a piece of music for the Los Angeles Games in 1984 that would kind of become the new Olympic theme. Now, when Williams was composing his piece of music, which he eventually titled Olympic Theme and Fanfare, Williams decided to integrate kind of a nod to Leo Arnault's Bugler's Dream into his music. And that's why it kind of opens the way it does. Now, what is Olympic Theme and Fanfare sound like? I'm going to sing it for you now. And then, of course, it goes into this melodic thing with strings. Da 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 da. So that is John Williams' Olympic theme and fanfare. Now, when Williams was writing this, he said in a 1992 interview that he wanted the music to reflect the spirit of cooperation, of heroic achievement, all the striving and preparation that go before the events, and all the applause that comes after them. Now, Olympic Theme and Fanfare made its world premiere on June 12th of 1984. At Symphony Hall with the Boston Pops. Now, Williams was the conductor of the Boston Pops at the time, so that's obviously to be expected. But that's the first time he pulled it out of the garage. That's the first time anyone heard that music. It was June 12, 1984. The West Coast premiere of Olympic Theme and Fanfare was held at the Hollywood Bowl on July 27th, 1984. And it was part of a concert that was called Prelude to the Games, which was broadcast live on Classical California, KUSC, as well as many other classical music radio stations across the country. The following day, John Williams himself conducted an orchestra, and they played the piece as part of the opening ceremonies of the 1984 Games in Los Angeles. Now, as I told you, NBC when they gained coverage of the 1988 Olympics moving on, they decided in 1996 at the Atlanta Games to combine those two pieces of music. Dun, 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 dun. Combine those two pieces of music to what we know today, and they've been combined ever since. So that is the Olympic theme music that you hear every single year you watch the Olympics. And I got to tell you, it's as iconic as any piece of music I've ever heard. That is the story behind it. So, folks, I hope you enjoyed that. I want to talk a little bit about the Live Aid documentary finale. Folks, this fourth episode was a little more interesting than I thought it would be, to be absolutely honest. They focused more on the subsequent concert that happened after Live Aid, which was titled Live 8. Now, what was Live 8? It was a concert that was put on across the world. And it was put on to focus leaders of the G8 countries to forgive African debt and also pledge more money for aid to Africa and other countries. Now, how did it all start? In 1999, Bono, who was a worldwide superstar at this point, and Bob Geldof began to focus on the AIDS epidemic in Africa. Back in 1999, 2000, AIDS was raging across the entire continent of Africa, and it was a real, real problem, medically and otherwise. In March of 2002, Bono met with Condoleezza Rice, and then subsequently President George W. Bush, to discuss not only AIDS relief, but also debt crisis relief for African nations. Bono, they say in the documentary, presented George W. Bush with an ancient Irish Bible because he knew that Bush was a man of faith. Apparently, according to George W. Bush in the documentary, he was very touched by that gesture. He appreciated that. So there was there. Bono talks about the fact that he knew and understood that U2 fans, many of them, would be annoyed with Bono himself meeting with George W. Bush and the Bush administration. But he also realized that some Republicans and supporters of the Bush administration would be annoyed with George W. Bush and his administration meeting with Bono, this rock and roll star. So he thought in order to get things done, everything will come out in the wash, which I think ended up being true. Because the Bush administration ended up pledging $15 billion to AIDS relief in Africa later that year, 2002. So obviously the meeting with Bono definitely moved the needle for George W. Bush and the Bush administration. Kudos to them for committing that money at the time. Now, as we said before, the concert Live 8 started around the idea of debt relief for African countries that had received aid prior. What do I mean by that? Apparently, the money that was distributed to African countries, Ethiopia and the like, I think several different countries had received aid from Live 8, that was presented to those countries in the form of a loan as opposed to a gift or a grant, which to me boggles the mind. How are you going to loan a country that has millions of people starving money to feed those people that end the famine and expect them to pay it back? To me, that makes zero sense. But apparently, if I understand correctly, this is what was happening with the aid that was received by the African countries, such as Ethiopia. The Western countries gave them the aid and said, okay, but this is a loan. You got to pay us back. And we're going to charge you interest until you do pay us back. which to me makes zero sense. Anyway, there were the G8 meeting, the annual G8 meeting that takes place at different places around the world, in 2005 was being held in Glen Eagles, which is not that far from London. And Geldof and Bono were interested in pressuring the G8 leaders to cancel the debt of these African countries that had received aid, and also to commit more aid money to provide relief to African countries that were struggling. Now, Bono apparently talked Bob Geldof into staging Live Aid by playing on the idea of the 20th anniversary of Live Aid, which was coming up that summer of 2005. Bono essentially used the idea of Paul McCartney singing the opening lines of Sgt. Pepper on the 20th anniversary of Live Aid, singing the lyrics, "It was 20 years ago today. Sgt. Pepper got the band to play," right? Famous line, right? So Bono basically sold Geldof into staging this on the 20th anniversary, essentially so they could have McCartney sing that part of the song, sing that song, and it actually be accurate. So the idea behind Live 8 was to have at least one concert in each of the G8 countries so that you can kind of globalize this appeal and globalize this cry for debt relief and for more aid to African countries. On May 31st of 2005, Bob Geldof launched Live 8 to take place on the 20th anniversary of Live Aid. Philadelphia was the only U.S. city where there was a concert. The other cities concerts were held in were Toronto, London, Paris, Edinburgh, Berlin, Rome, Moscow, and Tokyo. So as you can see, it was global in scale. There were concerts at all of those locations. To me, I think it probably weakened the impact to a degree of Live 8, simply because it was too dispersed. I believe if you kind of replicated the formula that you had for Live Aid, for Live 8, and having two locations, whether it's Philadelphia and London, whether it's London and Tokyo, whether it's Rome and Berlin, doesn't matter. If you'd done that, I think Live 8 probably would have been more memorable in the public's imagination. But that's just my opinion. Now, the British acts included, the ones that played, the acts that played London included U2, Coldplay, Elton John, Josh Stone, The Killers, Madonna played, Mariah Carey played in London, Sir Paul McCartney, Pink Floyd, R.E.M., Robbie Williams, oddly enough, Snoop Dogg played the London show, Sting and The Who, among many, many others. Those who played in the London leg of Live 8. Now, the Philadelphia show was strikingly different for Live 8 than it was for Live 8. Why? Because you had a lot more participation from Black American music artists. Will Smith essentially hosted Live 8, and he performed. The Black Eyed Peas performed. Bon Jovi performed. Destiny's Child was in Philadelphia. Kanye performed in Live 8. Jay-Z performed with Linkin Park, some iconic versions of his song. Alicia Keys was there. Maroon 5 was there. Rob Thomas was in Philadelphia. And Stevie Wonder, among many other stars, of course. Now, the interesting part, again, I told you, I think it was probably a little too dispersed. Live Aid occurred in 2005, and I don't have a genuine memory of sitting by my television watching every minute of Live 8. Again, I think because it was so, there were so many different concerts in so many different areas, I think it kind of watered down its potency, in my opinion. But to be fair, the leaders of the G8 met about 3 days after the concert, and they canceled the $40 billion of debt that African nations owed to Western nations completely. They canceled it outright. And that was literally, that money was owed by 18 of the poorest countries in the world to obviously some of the richest countries in the world. So Live 8 was very successful in getting debt cancellation. They also pledged these G8 nations to increase their aid to African nations to $50 billion a year by 2010. That number actually ended up only being increased to about $30 billion a year by 2010. But it's better than nothing. So I think on the face of it, you would have to say that Live 8 was a success. It's just not nearly as iconic as Live Aid was. First time is always hard to be. But do yourself a favor. Go back and look at some of the performances from Live 8. Some of them are actually very, very good. I can't believe I wasn't more locked in at the time in 2005 because some of the performances, I was in New York at the time, so I could have just hopped on the train or the bus, come down to Philadelphia and watch some of these acts. I mean, there's a big time lineup of groups that played Philadelphia. Yeah, I was asleep at the wheel. Anyway, moving on to the best quarterbacks who never made a Super Bowl appearance. Folks, I got to tell you, this is a very, very, very strange topic, but we're going to go through it, and I'm going to tell you what I think about it. But here it is. I'm going to give you three names, and that makes up the entire list, in my opinion, of great quarterbacks who have never made a Super Bowl appearance. Dan Fouts, Warren Moon, Philip Rivers. Folks, you have to understand that the great quarterback in the NFL throughout the history of the Super Bowl era has almost always found themselves in that game. The great quarterback gets to the Super Bowl. Whether they win it or not is immaterial. They get there. And it is so notable that Dan Fouts, who was a great, great quarterback, Warren Moon, who had a late start to his NFL career, but both he and Dan Fouts are Hall of Fame quarterbacks. They are in the Hall of Fame now. You can argue about whether or not you think they belong there. They are there. They're both Hall of Fame quarterbacks. And Philip Rivers is going to be in the Hall of Fame. He passed for like 63,000 yards. There's no way he's not going to be in the Hall of Fame. So that's what's notable about this list. Once you get past Fouts, Moon, and Rivers, the next set of quarterbacks, none of them are Hall of Famers. And they are all marginal when you list great, quote-unquote, quarterbacks. They fall a tier below at least, if not two. Who are the candidates who never made the Super Bowl? You got quarterbacks like Michael Vick. Quarterbacks like Jay Cutler, quarterbacks like Randall Cunningham, quarterbacks like Tony Romo. I mean, this is the level of quarterback you're talking about that did not make the Super Bowl once you get past those first three, Fouts, Moon, and Rivers. That's why this is such a short list. Again, it's the shortest list in the history of any sports conversation that you're ever going to see. No one else comes close to those top three having not made the Super Bowl. So let's get into each of these. And I want to tell you a little bit about their journey and why they stumbled, where they stumbled, what happened, and what it means after the fact. Now, it's interesting. Dan Fouts, those of you who don't know, was the quarterback for the San Diego Chargers. Tremendous quarterback. He came out of Oregon and was just a wonderfully talented quarterback. Could throw the ball anywhere you needed. To me, he was kind of like the original Dan Marino. Faust was just a great, great, great quarterback. He led the league in passing, passing yards, passer rating, and yards per attempt from 1979 to 1981, those three seasons. He actually went to the AFC Championship game in back-to-back years. Now, I personally still think that Dan Fouts' best chance to have gone to a Super Bowl came in the 1981 season. Now, in 1981, the Chargers played an epic divisional round game against the Miami Dolphins. And folks, if you don't know about this game, go look it up on YouTube. It was a tremendous game. The Chargers ended up winning it in overtime, 41-38 against Miami in Miami. It was really, really hot. It was incredibly humid. There's an iconic picture of Kellen Winslow walking off the field, bone tired, being supported by a couple of people with a towel over his head, literally just being glad to have survived the contest. In some ways, that game, if you go back and look at it, and the level of play, obviously it was a ton of offense, no defense, but there were two very good offenses at the time, so there's a reason for that. It was kind of like a football playoff version of the Thriller in Manila with Ali and Frazier when they fought that epic third fight in the Philippines in hot, humid, incredibly unhealthy conditions, and they both survived. But, you know, Ali said he never felt closer to death after that 15-round matchup with Joe Frazier. That's kind of what, in my opinion, the San Diego Charger-Miami Dolphin 1981 divisional playoff game was like. It was a tremendous game. Go back and watch it, or at least the highlights of it, if you get a chance. Now, what was the reward for the Chargers winning that slugfest against the Dolphins? Their reward was 1 week later, to go into Cincinnati and play the Bengals in what was called the Freezer Bowl. The wind chill temperatures were 59 below zero. Folks, I can't imagine what it was like to play in weather that cold. But more importantly, I can't imagine what it was like to play in weather that cold. Less than a week after recovering from an epic playoff football game that was held in Miami, hot and humid, the week before. So as you can imagine, the Chargers did not fare well in that game. They lost. I don't even remember the score, but they lost and weren't competitive in the game. Cincinnati, that game probably should have been canceled or at least postponed, but that was the NFL. They chose not to, and the game is a legendary game, kind of. So that, I think, was his best chance to actually get to the Super Bowl. He lost the AFC Championship game the year prior to a Raiders team where the Raiders kind of got out to the lead and Fouts tried to bring the Chargers back but didn't have enough. So if you look at Dan Fouts' overall postseason record, it was 3-4 over four seasons. In seven games, and he had a quarterback rating of 70. So he didn't really perform great in some of these postseason opportunities. But again, you're playing against the very best, so you don't always perform to your same standard. Now, Warren Moon, very strange case. Very, very strange. Of the three quarterbacks we're talking about, Fouts, Rivers, and Moon, Moon is the only quarterback of those three who never even made it to a conference championship. That's how strange Warren Moon's case is. Folks, you have to listen to a little bit of Warren Moon's checkered postseason career because it is checkered, but it's not necessarily his fault. Why do I say that? Look, Warren Moon, he posted an 84.9% passer rating during his seven-year playoff career, right? Which was right in line with what Warren Moon did in the regular season. Those same years, his passer rating on the regular season was 84 0.2%. So again, regular season for every playoff appearance year he made, his passer rating was 84.2. In the postseason of those same seven seasons, his passer rating was 84.9. So he actually improved his play in the postseason over the course of those 7 years. Now, the problem is the defenses that played on Moon teams, on the teams that Warren Moon represented, they were the exact opposite of Warren Moon. In those regular seasons, that those seven seasons that Moon's team made the playoffs, his defense allowed 19.7 points a game in those 7 years that a team Warren Moon quarterback made the playoffs. In the playoffs, those same defenses averaged 26 points a game. They gave up a touchdown more in the postseason than they did in the regular season for all seven seasons of those postseason appearances of Warren Moon quarterback teams. So it was very, very strange. I mean, I'm going to give you a couple of examples of what Warren Moon did when he was in the playoffs. And this is why it's very strange. 1993, Warren Moon's team is the Houston Oilers, and they had a 12-4 record, and they played a Chiefs team in the divisional playoffs, I believe. And the Chiefs were, I don't know what their record was, but the Oilers had beaten the Chiefs in week two of that same regular season, 30-0. Now, that regular season game was quarterbacked by Dave Craig for the Chiefs. By the time they got to the playoffs, the postseason matchup quarterback for the Chiefs was the legendary Joe Montana. Now, both Joe Montana and Warren Moon were 37 years old at the time, 1993, okay? Montana's numbers, he went 22 of 38 for 299 yards in that game, three touchdowns, two interceptions, two sacks, and an 87.5 quarterback rating. Warren Moon, in that same game, went 32 of 43, 306 yards, one touchdown, one interception. He was sacked nine times in that game. And he had a QBR. He had a quarterback rating of 91.8. But Warren Moon also fumbled five times in that game against the Chiefs. Chiefs win 28-20. So the Oilers were in that game, obviously. But apparently, Moon was getting mauled the entire game. He got sacked nine times in the game, which is crazy. Of course, he fumbles five times. That doesn't help. In the year prior, 1992, Warren Moon participated in one of the most famous postseason losses in the history of football. Obviously, the historic 41-38 loss to the Buffalo Bills, where the Oilers blew a 35-3 lead. I think Buffalo hosted that game, actually. In that game, Warren Moon was 36 of 50 for 371 yards, four touchdowns, two interceptions, four sacks, and one fumble. What I remember about that game, more than anything else, obviously, if you have a 35-3 lead, you're going to have some very good stats, most likely as a quarterback. What I remember about that game is that in the second half, for whatever reason, not only did the defense collapse, but for whatever reason, Warren Moon couldn't make a play to kind of stop the bleeding. It was very similar to Matt Ryan in the Super Bowl against Tom Brady when the Patriots came from 25 down, I think, to win that Super Bowl, biggest comeback in Super Bowl history. Matt Ryan was never able, he didn't do anything necessarily wrong, but he couldn't make a play to actually stop the bleeding, to stop the Patriot momentum. This same thing happened in this game with the Oilers and the Bills back in 1992. Now, in 1991, Warren Moon and his Houston Oilers lost a divisional round game to John Elway and the Broncos. Now, in that game, Elway went 19 of 33 with one touchdown, one interception, no sacks, one fumble, and a quarterback rating of 80. In that game, Warren Moon, now remember, Denver hosted the game, so they were on the road. Warren Moon went 27 of 36 for 325 yards, three touchdowns, one interception, no sacks, no fumbles, and a quarterback rating of 118.4. Folks, strangely enough, even though Warren Moon never reached a conference championship game, he played well enough in these postseason losses to have won at least a chance to get to a conference championship game. And certainly, those teams were good enough to possibly get to the Super Bowl. So it's kind of strange that he never even got to a conference championship, not to mention a Super Bowl. Warren Moon's postseason record was 3-7 over seven seasons, 10 games, with a quarterback rating of 84.9. Now, we get to Phillip Rivers. Folks, most people know Phillip Rivers, very, very talented quarterback, went to, I think, NC State and played for the Chargers forever before moving on to Indianapolis. I think that's the only other team he played for. Of course, in 2006, Phillip Rivers makes his postseason debut when his 14-2 Chargers hosted the 12-4 New England Patriots. Folks, that year, they were coached by Marty Schottenheimer, who has suffered some of the most devastating postseason losses in the history of any coach's career in the NFL. LaDainian Tomlinson was the MVP that season. And the Chargers led with a 21-13 lead with 6 minutes and 25 seconds to go in the game. Most of you know this already, but I'm going to go through this. Tom Brady threw an interception on 4th-and-5 from the San Diego 41. And that should have salted the game away. But the San Diego Charger who intercepted the ball, Marlon McCree, was trying to gain more yards on the interception return, ends up fumbling the ball back to the Patriots. And of course, the Patriots subsequently score a touchdown and convert on a two-point conversion to tie the game with 4 minutes, 36 seconds left. The Chargers get the possession after the Patriots score. They go 3-and-out on that possession. Brady then hits Rashay Caldwell on a 3rd-and-10 pass over Quentin Jammer for 49 yards, which leads to a field goal by the Patriots to take the lead with 1 minute, 10 seconds left in the game. Rivers and the Chargers get the ball back. Nate Kading, the second team all-pro kicker of that season, a Pro Bowl kicker in that year in the NFL, then missed a 54-yard kick in San Diego at home that would have sent the game to overtime. Patriots win 24-21. Folks, that 2006 divisional round playoff game was Phillip Rivers' postseason debut. He was 25 at the time, right? So literally, he's one game from the AFC Championship with 6:25 to go in the game against the vaunted New England Patriots, and they end up losing the game. The year after, 2007, after beating Vince Young and the Titans, Rivers and Peyton Manning played the divisional round game in Indianapolis, and the Chargers end up winning that game 28-24. But Rivers has to leave the game in the third quarter with a torn patella tendon. LaDainian Tomlinson ends up injuring his knee and leaves the game in the first quarter. And somehow, even with those injuries, both Rivers and Tomlinson end up giving it a go against the Patriots the following week in New England. Now, they end up losing the game. Rivers, I think, plays the whole game somehow. Tomlinson has to tap out after three carries against the Patriots in that AFC Championship game. Antonio Gates, he had a dislocated toe at the time also. He could only muster two catches on six targets for 17 yards against the Patriots that year. Now, again, this is the 2007 Patriots, the undefeated team. So if the Chargers are healthy, they probably put up a better fight. But who knows? A series of errors and poorly timed injuries really kind of hurt Rivers' chance to reach a Super Bowl when he had a couple of really good chances to get there. But again, poorly timed injuries, errors, basically ended up getting in the way. Phillip Rivers' postseason record was 5-7 over seven seasons, 12 games played with an 85.2 quarterback rating. Now, folks, why does this matter? Why am I going over this information? I'll tell you exactly why. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about who needs to make a Super Bowl appearance more, Lamar Jackson or Josh Allen. This is the reason we asked that question. This list of quarterbacks, total of three, who are all-time greats, they never made the actual Super Bowl. You don't want to be on this list. And right now, both Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen, if their careers continue on the direct trajectory they're on now, will be on this list. Lamar Jackson's postseason record right now is 3-5 over five seasons, with eight playoff games. He has a quarterback rating of 84.6. Josh Allen's postseason record is currently 7-6 over six seasons, 13 games, with a quarterback rating of 101.7. Folks, the clock is ticking for both Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen. They have to find a way to make it to the Super Bowl this season or next. Why? Because no one wants to hear about the fact that in order to get to the Super Bowl, you had to go through Patrick Mahomes, right? In order to get to the Super Bowl, Patrick Mahomes had to go through Tom Brady. In order to get to the Super Bowl, Tom Brady had to go through Peyton Manning. In order to go to the Super Bowl, Peyton Manning had to go through Tom Brady. Greats, all-time greats, always have to go through other all-time greats to become all-time greats. That's what makes you an all-time great. So no one wants to hear about the traffic ahead of Lamar and Josh, the traffic being Patrick Mahomes. You have to find a way to beat him. Joe Burrow's found a way to beat him. If you're Lamar Jackson, if you're Josh Allen, you have to find a way to beat Patrick Mahomes. Now, that says nothing of the fact that who knows what's going to happen if and when one of these younger quarterbacks actually starts to make a leap. You know, Joe Burrow, maybe he gets Cincinnati back in the playoffs finally again, and he's going to be a big, tough out to get around. What happens if C.J. Stroud or Justin Herbert or Bo Nix with Denver Broncos or Cam Ward or Trevor Lawrence even puts it all together in the next couple of years? That's yet another set of teams that both Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen are going to have to navigate and play through. So the time is now for them. They literally cannot wait any longer. They both had opportunities. Obviously, Josh has been much closer to the Super Bowl than Lamar ever has. But they have to find a way to get to the Super Bowl. Great quarterbacks in the NFL make it to the game. And you cannot, for any reason, if you're Lamar Jackson or Josh Allen, in your career without having made it to a Super Bowl. But the good news is, in my opinion, I think one of them will make it to the Super Bowl this season. And I'm going to tell you who in a couple weeks, as soon as we do our NFL season preview, which is coming up in a couple weeks. But for tonight, well, I should say for this morning, that is the show. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. My name is Cyrus Farmer. You have been watching and listening to the Stomp the Tea podcast. We will be back next week, as always. And we welcome your comments. We welcome your support again. And as always, we'll see you on the first tee.